I quit drinking and started running on the same day. So in a lot of ways, I replaced drinking with running. And I think that's very common. And it's from one addiction to another.
That was Nicole Antoinette, writer, podcast host, and recovering self-help addict. And this is the Running on Ohm podcast. I'm your host, Julia Hanlon. And I'm so excited to share with all of you about an October giveaway where you can win a Nutso swag bag. So what's even Nutso, you're asking? Well, it's the only 7 nut and seed butter on the planet. So just take a moment to think about the best peanut butter you've ever had, and that on steroids. Nutso's various flavors use combinations of 10 different organic nuts and seeds to make each jar an omega-3 powerhouse of nutrition. I've gotta admit that my favorite flavor is the chocolate power fuel. That is 70% organic Peruvian dark chocolate, chia seeds, in addition to almonds, cashews, hazelnuts, pumpkin seeds, Brazil nuts, and flax seeds. Yep, you heard it right. The chocolate power fuel is peanut-free, so that all my peanut-free friends out there can get a spoonful too. And it's that good that you're gonna eat it by the spoonful. So how do you try Nutso and win a free swag bag of Nutso jars, a Nutso hat and shirt? Well, it's actually pretty simple. All you have to do is leave Running on Ohm a review on the iTunes store, send a screenshot of your review to runningonohm@gmail.com or tweet it to @runningonohm, and the giveaway ends October 31st. The winner will be randomly chosen and announced by November 2nd. Now, on to our show. Hey everyone, if this is your first time tuning into Running on Ohm, welcome. And if this is your 152nd time, welcome back. I'm your host, Julia Hanlon, and I want you to know that Running on Ohm is more than just a podcast about running and yoga. It's conversations with wellness pioneers who explore the mind-body connection through different mediums. From actors, meditators, musicians, authors, Olympic gold medalists, chefs to surfers, I believe that the stories of the people that I bring on for all of you every week can change your life. And over the past 2 years, I've flirted with one podcast a week, publishing 2, and then during one crazy week of Rue Rises, published 7 podcasts in 7 days. I definitely don't recommend doing that, but I'm now returning to 2 podcasts a week regularly. And some of you may not even realize this, but after I record one interview, it takes up to 10 hours to prepare the podcast for your listening experience. I am so committed to giving you all the most professional, authentic, and incredible guests every week, twice a week, but I also need your help in spreading the word about Running on Ohm. So tell a friend, share it on your social media, leave a review, anything you can do to help me grow this podcast together counts. This is a conversation that you're going to want to share with your friends. So who is today's guest, Nicole Antoinette? She is a writer, host of her own podcast show called Real Talk Radio that I would definitely recommend listening to, self-described recovering self-help addict, and so much more. In our conversation, we explore how to develop real talk in your life. And start with Nicole's lead. Nicole tells the story about how she stopped drinking alcohol and began running and blogging about her experience. Her blog began to reach thousands, and for 8 years, Nicole wrote weekly about her journey. People could relate to her real talk on her blog, and then she even expanded her work to include accountability coaching, where she coached over 400 people. Nicole opens up on why she's moved away from blogging and coaching presently, and the role of her bipolar disorder that it has on her work life. This is definitely one of the most honest conversations I've ever had on air, and I'm excited to share it with all of you. Nicole inspires me to want to begin to share my story with all of you, and I hope she will move you too to ask yourself what's true for you that you've been denying, and are you practicing real talk in your relationships with yourself and others? So get ready to go deep and have your world rocked by Nicole Antoinette.
The limitations, like if I were to only do that, I'd be very limited because I don't really travel, and like so many of the people I want to talk to are in like other countries and other things, you know, that like I think I'm kind of stuck with Skype.
Yeah, I think I hear you. I think at the same time, though, I mean, you don't necessarily know where your life's direction's headed, in the sense that who knows what opportunities may show up for you through the podcast and where you may be able to travel.
Yeah.
And start interviewing people in person. And once you do it in person, it's like whole nother level.
Yeah. I don't really love traveling, to be honest. So I think for me, like it wouldn't, like if I had a thing where like I had to travel to do it.
Okay.
Like I don't love, like, feel like that's like a weird thing to say, but I don't love traveling. So
it's not a weird thing to say. I mean, traveling takes a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And it's so uprooting. And that can be exhausting for people who are, you know, people who like to be grounded in their daily lives and their rituals.
I'm a homebody for sure. So.
Yeah.
So hopefully from now on, Skype will just work. That's my hope.
Yeah. So when did you feel inspired to start your own podcast?
I wanted to do it for about a year and a half, kind of similar story to you, that I'm a big podcast consumer. And I have done a lot of audio things, either been guests on other people's podcasts or, you know, for certain programs and stuff that I have run in my business, like had people on to do kind of more like private calls, like stuff that just wasn't widely released. And I really like just like the conversational aspect. I like the conversational model. And so it was something that I always thought was fun and I wanted to try it. And the big reason that I put it off for at least a year and a half was because I don't like personally the model of I have to create content every single week. Like I have to release something every, like I don't like committing to something that feels like it has no end date. For some reason that just like feels very stressful for me. And I had this idea that I wanted to do podcasting the way that Netflix does shows, like release a whole season at once. Like I'm a binge consumer. Like I want to watch the whole thing. I want to listen to the whole thing. And like for me, with some of the podcasts that I subscribe to, even though I love them, you know, they're adding new episodes once a week or twice a week. And it makes me feel stressed out because like if they add them faster than I can listen to them, I'm like, oh my God, they're just going to keep coming and I'm never going to get to them all. And then I wind up deleting them. And I mean, this is all a very first world problem, but I thought, what if I could just release it as a whole season? And I thought, well, that's not what people do. And I thought, well, why not? Right. So I finally had that moment of, why don't I just try this as like a standalone project, 8 episodes, put it together, see how I feel, see if people like the long form interview style kind of conversations. So did the first season and released it at the end of August. And it was a good experiment. That's for sure.
So. Yeah. And I've listened to some of those interviews and have been really moved and amazed at the level of connection and intimacy you're able to draw forth in the people you're interviewing, despite my prejudice to Skype these days.
So thanks. That's really cool. Nice. I mean, I think I'm grateful that everyone that I had on the first season are pretty good friends. So I think that there's like a level of intimacy that's built into that. You know what I mean? Which was great. It was just kind of like a mix of people that I love, like, please come tell your story. Let's just talk about stuff. And, you know, a lot of the podcasts that I listen to are topic specific. And I liked the idea of having something where like the theme or the lens, Real Talk Radio, that's the name of the podcast, is just that. Like, it's just about having like honest and unfiltered conversations, that it doesn't have to be about, you know, because we eat the same way or because we run or because we this, or, you know, it was like a nice opportunity to get people together who you might look at that group of people and think, what do they have in common? Right. But it's not necessarily that they all fit like a certain mold. It's just to have conversations with people who I find interesting and inspiring and get a chance to ask them a lot of questions, I guess. Like, I like that. I like knowing. I think we are all very voyeuristic. Like, we want to know, okay, well, what did you do this morning? Like, what did you eat for breakfast? Like, what are you reading? You know, what are you afraid of? That type of stuff. And I think giving air to those types of conversations is important.
I completely agree. And I feel like this podcast, Running on Ohm, the mission of Real Talk Radio is very similar. I am really interviewing people whose life work is somehow connected to mind and body. And I would argue that everyone's life work is connected to mind, body. Yes, runners and yogis, which are my particular passions, really embody those in a great way. But I mean, I've had authors, I've had surfers, golfers, the whole gamut, you know, and everyone can be open to real talk if they're ready for it.
So yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I definitely agree. Mm-hmm.
I want to return to something you said, though, about the pressure of releasing something on a weekly basis. And I think that's a really interesting thing to kind of sit with, because you were a blogger for 8 years, and that was a really big part of your life. And I'd love to hear a little bit about, when was the turning point for you when you realized, yeah, I don't want to do this in this like daily grind?
So it's interesting, right? So I started blogging, July 2007, which I guess in like internet lifespan feels like a really long time ago. And, you know, I was a year out of college and my life was kind of a mess. And I had always, you know, been writing privately. And I really just kind of learned about blogging. And I thought, this sounds fun. Like, let me tell stories on the internet. And it was this very fun kind of personal blog, really just a way to chronicle my day-to-day life and to be open about things that I felt like people weren't talking about very much. Relationship with parents, mental health stuff, you know, just like different challenges. And So I really didn't put a lot of thought into starting the blog. I just thought, oh, this is a thing. Like, click, 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 type, 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 type. I'm going to do this, right? And from there, it morphed into something that became a huge part of my social life. So not really my work at all. I used to run a children's day camp. So I spent 5 years doing that. Actually, almost got fired over my blog, which is a separate story we can return to later if you'd like.
I would love to return to that story.
And I met a ton of great friends. I mean, at this point, I have one really good friend from high school, but everyone else in my life, somehow I met them through the internet, which is pretty crazy, either through Twitter or through blogging. Like, it became a really great outlet for me socially. And so I kept blogging and, you know, had been a very public party girl for a lot of years. That was a big part of my blog, was just kind of crazy drunken shenanigans. And in 2011, I quit drinking. And quit drinking and started running on the same day. Like, running was really kind of the way out of the drinking hole for me. And I had never been an athlete and couldn't run for 2 minutes when I first started and was really kind of a complete beginner. And I blogged about that process. And, you know, here were these wonderful people who were in my audience or in my community who had seen, okay, well, her life was this way and she's actually making these changes on a day-to-day basis. And I started to get a lot of questions from people who, I think for them, I represented like more of a real person doing that, not here's this fitness blogger who seems like she's always been doing this thing. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I think that it can be a little bit hard to relate to if you're like, all I do is eat cookies and sit on the couch. Like, because for sure I was like gin, cookies, couch. That was my life. And so I started to get a lot of questions about that. And I thought, oh, this is cool. Like, some people want to do similar things. Like, maybe I can help them. And then I started to get more questions and more of the same questions. And I thought, okay, there's something here. And that was in 2012. And I thought maybe I should draw some lines around this and like see about making this a business. So turning it, you know, kind of starting a business off of the heels of my blog was a very organic process. Like, I never sat down and thought, I really want to start, you know, X business and I'm going to do this, this, and this. It all just kind of happened, which in a lot of ways was lovely because it felt really organic. But in some other ways, I don't think that I gave it the thought and consideration that you do if you think, I want to start, let's say I'm going to start a jewelry making business. I don't know why I just thought that. It's a strange example. But, and then you sit down and think through all of what that entails, right? So there was not that much thought that went into it for me. So, you know, I did this for 3 years and it became, you know, a coaching business and working with people really on goal setting and accountability coaching, helping them close the gap between what they say they want and what they actually do. And, you know, it was great through one-on-one and small groups and virtual and in person. I worked with, I mean, well over 400 people in 3 years. It was great. It was like a great experience. But somewhere along the way, I don't know. I know this is like a very long answer to your question, but,
we're here to have long, real talk.
Right. Right. I don't know. So some things just started feeling a little bit out of alignment. So this is an interesting time for you and I to be having this conversation, because I'm in like a very big pivot point right now. And, you know, that idea of needing to produce content on a regular basis, I didn't ever feel that need when I was just blogging for fun. And then because it became a business, I started to feel, I don't want to say resentful because I think that's too negative of a word, but I started to feel this pressure of, well, you have to keep putting out this content. But now it wasn't just sharing for the sake of sharing. It was also sharing with a mindset of building a business, that when it also becomes your livelihood, you're very aware of, okay, well, I'm going to blog about this thing. Does this support like the sale of this program, or does it, you know? So, and there, I think there came a point for me where that didn't feel amazing anymore, that instead of giving myself complete freedom to write and talk about everything that I wanted to write about, I started to censor a little bit along the lines of, if I put this out there, will this make someone not want to be my client? And I think that, not to say that anything I have put out isn't true, it's all true, but like anything else, it's only a part of who we are, right? Like, you can be as authentic as possible, but it's still not your whole everything. And there were a couple of times where there was stuff that I wanted to write about and specifically chose not to, because I'm like, oh, well, how is this going to make this person feel if then we get on the phone for a coaching call and they've just read that I'm like in the deep dark hole of depression this week? Or, you know, is that going to change something? And, you know, I at that time decided to kind of pull back on blogging and start to rethink a lot of this stuff. So...
And so in the timeline, was that over a year ago, or that was in the past year that you've kind of pulled back from that capacity?
It's only really recently, you know, it's in the last month. So we're right now, what, September at the time of this call, yeah. Mid-September. And a lot of the current iteration of my business is wrapping up this month.
So was that hard to tell your clients that you'd been working with, like, hey, I'm
super hard
closing up shop?
Also, I mean, I love them. They're like, I'm incredibly grateful, and I feel like incredibly lucky to have just worked with not just women, but mostly women, just incredible women, just these like fantastic, like getting on the phone with them was always so wonderful. And so it wasn't a matter of, I don't like this anymore, so I'm not going to do it. And it wasn't a matter of, it's not going well, so I'm not going to do it. So it was kind of a weird place where I just like, I guess the truest thing that I can say about it is that I feel that I'm more called to writing and storytelling and kind of story sharing and fostering this type of conversation than to coaching specifically. Not, I don't know what's going to happen in the future. You know, if this comes, you know, maybe I'll wind up coaching in a different capacity or doing something like that. But I feel, based on just the feedback that I get from people when I share this type of stuff, that like that's where my power is to just kind of share what's true for me. Like I've always, not always, the last couple of years, I think I've felt that my superpower, if you're going to call it that, is to help people get to the heart of what's true for them without judgment. And I think that can happen in a coaching capacity for sure. But I think it happens more so for me by speaking to what's true for me, and then other people can take what they want from that. And I think that, it's a scary transition. It's not a huge pivot. It's not like I'm doing things so drastically different, but it's a scary transition because I know the type of work that I want to be doing creatively, but I don't know where the money path is for that. So that's kind of been like an interesting piece of this that I think a lot of people don't really talk about when you make money off of a personal brand or, you know, that type of stuff. Like what happens when you want to change? If your brand, I felt like my brand was very built on quit drinking, started running, like became vegan, like was doing this, like very goal oriented. And like, what happens then when you're in a space where maybe you don't want to set goals or you want to take a break, or, you know, I quit running temporarily or maybe not at the beginning of May. And it's like people expect a certain thing, or maybe they don't. Maybe that's just me projecting outwards. Like, oh my God, what are people going to think that I'm not running or I'm not doing this anymore? You know? And I felt like I had built myself a box in which I didn't have the freedom to change.
I can totally relate to that. I mean, I think you're definitely farther along the path than I am, both in the experience you've had building your own brand and your company. But I think this is an issue that a lot of young entrepreneurs face, the issues that you're speaking to of authenticity, of freedom of speech, you know, and freedom to express the full highs and lows of our being.
Yeah.
And it's like when people, I've struggled with at times feeling like people will put me on a pedestal. And then, as you said, it's like, then you have to live up to that. And that's a lot of pressure.
I mean, and I think for the most part, it was never like someone said to me, you can't change, or I expect this, that, or the other. It was stuff that I internalized. Like, yes. I thought I have to be this and I have to be that. And I mean, a lot of times people don't care as much as we think they do. Like
we are the center of our universe.
Oh my God. Right. Like I think it's like such a big deal if I stop blogging. So like, nobody really cares. Right. So like that has been kind of a refreshing, like, humility check for me. Like, you're not as special as you think you are. You're not as, like, you know, important as you think you are. And it's fine to make changes and to do stuff. And I think that whatever happens kind of next in this like next iteration of stuff, I just want to be a little bit more intentional about, you know, what I'm building and what I'm committing myself to. And I've seen, you know, because I've done lots of different styles of programs, you know, DIY things or group things or in person or not in person, or, you know, things that have a live Facebook group component or all this stuff. And I find consistently the lesson that I need to keep relearning is that I don't like things where I have to indefinitely add content, or like I'm a very obsessive person, meaning like if I'm into something, I'm all into it and I really, really want to do it until I don't. So it's like I need things to have an end date. That's why, like with the podcast, that I told myself, like, you're recording 8 episodes, like this is an experiment. If at the end of releasing this first season, for any reason, you don't want to keep doing this, you don't have to. And like that made it really fun for me to do, because I felt like you have an out and it's okay to be totally obsessed and then move on to the next thing and then move on to the next thing. So I'm looking, I've taken the pressure off of trying to figure out, you know, what's my career or like, what do I do or that type of stuff. And I'm focusing more on just a series of projects. Like, well, right now the project that feels fun is, you know, recording a second season of the podcast. And, you know, I just wrote a collection of like short humor stories about my mom. And so it's like I'm trying to take things one project at a time and feel like very clear that I have a purpose for each project, as opposed to trying to think, you know, what do I do? And trying to answer these like really big questions.
And I think that's such a beautiful paradigm shift to be having. And it's a really cool evolution because I think a lot of people can actually learn from that evolution of creating more contained projects instead of that indefinite abyss of having to keep up the Nicole vegan runner, former drinker, you know, persona. Like, it's actually more contained. I would like to go back to the story, though, about this children's summer camp. Yeah. Let's go.
Yeah, so when I was in college, I went to high school in Southern California, and I went to school in New York and so I would be, you know, back in California during the summer, and I wound up working in kind of the day camp system out there, I guess, and that turned from one camp into another. I got, I guess, like camp headhunted. Not that, I don't think that's a thing, but moved from one camp to another, and it was this camp that had been failing, you know, not making money for years, and so they brought me and another woman in to basically, what can you do with this? Like, can you fix this? And I was 20, right? So like very young, I think, to be doing this. And we had a really successful year, and then she got married and kind of like disappeared off into the ether, and they were kind of left with, wait, we had this really successful year and now she's gone. And they offered me the opportunity to take over this camp. You know, I hadn't even turned 21 yet, and I don't think that was the best decision on their part, just because like that's, I don't know. I look back at what I was in charge of, you know, having to hire and train a staff of 40 people and being in charge of this whole budget and having hundreds and hundreds of kids like at the camp. Like it was fantastic in a lot of ways. And I mean, you were
20 years old.
Yeah. I turned 21 a couple days before my first year as like the main, like in charge of the whole thing.
This
director
is like a
started.
Comedy show.
Oh my God. Honestly, I don't know what the statute of limitations is on things. So I don't know what I'm going to say and not say, but I'm lucky that it didn't become just like a complete shitstorm. Like it was fantastic, but I made a lot of not great decisions. And that was when I was like in the height of my like extreme drinking. I have bipolar disorder, and that was before I got properly diagnosed. And so it was just like not like the best time. And, I had been blogging, you know, throughout the whole thing, and it was my last year there. I tried to quit a bunch of times, and I kept, you know, coming back to it just because it was there and it was easy and I liked it. It was, you know, it's one of those situations where I feel like it's relatively easy to walk away from a terrible situation, but it's pretty hard to walk away from something that's good but not great, whether that's like a job or a relationship or like it was money. I knew how to do it. It was exciting. It was but it wasn't amazing, but it was good enough. And it's like very hard, I think, to pull yourself out of that kind of situation. So I said I was going to quit, and then I didn't quit, you know, and that was year three. I came back, said I was going to quit. I didn't quit. Year four and year five, I said to myself, you know, like this for sure has to be your last year. And the board found out, I guess, that I had this blog. Not that I was trying to hide it. You know, the president of the board knew, and I guess just never really said anything. And it kind of came up. So someone complained, like someone on an parent or something, they got some kind of anonymous complaint because my blog is not very PG and, you know, I use whatever language. And, you know, they brought me in for this like very official meeting that they wouldn't tell me what it was about. And, you know, they had printed out a couple of blog posts that I had written in which I had like referenced camp and like told camp stories, not like kids by name, not pictures of kids. Like I'm not completely stupid, maybe at that point, but so I came in for this meeting, and it was this like very scary situation. It was 2 weeks into a 9-week summer session. And, you know, they sat me down and they were, you know, basically told me that I had to like delete all of this and shut down my blog, you know, and all this type of stuff. And I sat there, and so I let them talk and I let them talk. And then, you know, I said, first of all, I didn't violate anything. Like this was never like a part of my contract. They said it was like against trade secrets. I'm like, what trade secrets do you think are happening in this thing? And I took this deep breath and I was like, you know what? If you're asking me to choose between my writing and this job, then you better find somebody else by Monday. And it was like you could have heard a pin drop. They all looked at me like they thought there was no way that that's what I was going to say, that I was going to be so apologetic and like so, oh my God, please don't fire me. And this was a Friday afternoon. I was like, well, you better find somebody else for Monday. And they were all just like, because, I mean, what are they going to do? The season, people had signed up for this camp because of what I had created and this type of stuff. So they were kind of backed into a corner, and they were like, if they came back to me with, you know, okay, we'll just delete those posts and like, don't write about it. Don't write about camp anymore. And like, I guess you can stay. But for me, it's actually funny that we're talking about this story, because I hadn't thought about this in a really long time until recently with this same kind of job transition, where I felt like some of the work that I was doing with coaching and with that type of stuff, even though I loved it, it was getting in the way of the writing that I wanted to do. And like, it's obviously not as clear cut of an example, but I thought, okay, well, I'm here again in this decision point. Like, at what point am I going to really choose to write the things that I want to write, like with complete freedom and no strings attached? And so I've been thinking about that story more lately. Like, well, I was ready to walk out on that situation and, you know, maybe it's time to do that again.
That's amazing.
It takes like being in your early 20s and drunk, I guess, also. But I think I lucked out the way it went, sort of, but I was fully prepared for them to be like, okay, bye. You know?
What's incredible though is it sounds like it was such an instinctual response for you to be like writing or my job. You know, there was no question, it sounds like. There was no hesitation in you. And that speaks to your character. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it was a product of, I knew that I needed to leave that job. And, you know, kind of what we were talking about before about, you know, being an obsessive person who likes, you know, I describe it as being like a light switch person where like I'm either totally obsessed or not at all interested and there's no middle ground and I can't really fake it. And when I'm done, I'm done. And I used to see that until pretty recently as a bad thing. Like I thought that meant that I was flaky or non-committal or that I couldn't stick with things. Like I really judged that a lot. And so when times would come, like with this camp, this is a great example, I knew that I wanted to leave 2 years before I left. But because I thought, well, you should stick this out and this isn't terrible. So what's wrong with you that you like think the grass is greener? And like, it was a lot of really negative self-talk. And because I didn't just give myself permission to let what's true be true, I really made a mess of things. Like I, you know, slept with people that I shouldn't have slept with that like were on, you know, the staff at that camp and, you know, was drinking a lot. I mean, I just like made a lot of bad decisions that I basically made it. So I like set the whole thing on fire so that I had to leave. So like
it was a sabotage of
exactly.
sorts, a self-sabotage
of completely
sorts.
That. And I've done that. I mean, you know, a relationship that I didn't want to be in anymore, but I, you know, didn't have the guts to break up with. So I just moved across the country instead. Like I just have like
but
a history
what
of
addicts
this.
Do.
I mean, right, right.
So I don't think it's like, it's not, I mean, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the drinking, and you've alluded to the fact that you're a party girl drinking. Like, what does the term alcoholic mean to you? And was that something you used to describe yourself? And how did you stop drinking? Because there's a lot of people, especially in the endurance sports world, who are very extreme and who have that addictive personality.
Yeah, I've never self-described as an alcoholic. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, too. I don't really know. Like, I don't know what the technical definition of that is. I know that my behavior around drinking was not healthy and not sustainable. So I think that it's hard when I think with labels like alcoholic, like I think some people find that comforting because it's okay, this is what I am. I can't drink again. Like there's no option. Like there is something that is comforting about this is the label, right? But I think that for anyone who maybe doesn't identify as that or doesn't qualify or whatever we want to say, it's kind of messy because at the time, I didn't feel like my drinking behaviors were so far out of the ordinary because I had friends that, you know, would binge drink on the weekends or do this, or it's very kind of like social, especially in New York, like party girl, you're in college, this is just what happens. Like I think there was a lot of being able to normalize it for myself, which doesn't mean that it's okay. Like just because other people that you know behave a certain way doesn't mean that that's great behavior. So I think for me, it took really looking at the reasons why I was drinking, and that it was almost like I feel like I was a social drinker with no off button, where like there was, it's not like, like a lot of it was social drinking, but way more drinks than I needed to have, or not that you ever need to have a drink, but I finally realized that I was just not making good choices, and I didn't have a lot of self-esteem because I wasn't doing esteemable things. And, you know, I came to a head for me in a really interesting way. I had had terrible insomnia for about 6 years, sleeping 2 hours a night, 3 hours a night, sometimes not at all, like awful. Tried what I thought was everything, the doctors, the sleeping pills, this, you know, tried everything, finally wound up, I was living in San Francisco at the time, going to an acupuncturist, which I didn't believe in. And I was very cynical about, and I was like, this is like all like new age bullshit, which is so funny because it's not new age at all, right? Like how long has acupuncture and like traditional Chinese medicine been around? But I went there after, it was, you know, 3 a.m. and I was like frantic Googling, you know, insomnia, this type of stuff. And Google was basically like, acupuncture works, like just go. So I made this appointment and I went, and it was my first session. I told her, you know, all my symptoms, how long this has been going on. She did whatever exam she did. She was like, well, it's the alcohol. And I was completely not expecting that at all.
Did you tell her that you drank a lot, or she read that from your body?
I mean, I answered her questions. I think I wasn't as forthcoming as I could have been, but I, you know, mentioned that I was drinking most days, and, you know, she was, you know, asking quantities, and then whatever I fell on her chart was, you know, I think a little bit of a red flag. And then she did whatever the exam. So I don't know if it was a combination of that and something that she found in my body. And she was like, why don't you quit drinking for 5 weeks and we'll see what happens. And at that point, the pain of the insomnia was greater than the fear of what would happen to my social life and life if I stopped drinking. So I think for me, I tend not to make a change until it's so painful. Like, it gets to the point where, like, the pain of not making the change is greater than the fear of the change.
Exactly.
And so in that regard, I think it was the advice that came at the right time, that I was so sick of not sleeping that she could have been like, here's a knife, cut out your kidney and then you'll be able to sleep. And I would have been like, okay, where's the bathtub? Like, it was, you know, it was that type of thing. Like, I was just so tired. And, so I said, okay, I'm going to try this. And again, I was very skeptical, but I quit drinking, and maybe 5 days into it, I was sleeping like 7 or 8 hours a night. And it was like a whole new world. Like, I hadn't been sleeping for 6 years, and it was.
Well, and no wonder you were drinking so much, because it was probably a way to medicate the insomnia.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was a way to medicate the insomnia. It was a way to medicate the bipolar disorder that I didn't know that I had, which then made both of those things worse. Like, it was just like a terrible, terrible cycle. Plus, I mean, I started drinking when I was 18, so not terribly young, but I started drinking at 18 very heavily right away. And so I never learned how to be an adult without alcohol. So I never learned like how to process my feelings and that type of stuff. So my only real response, oh, I'm mad, probably I should drink. Oh, I'm celebrating, I'm going to drink. Like, I'm going to, and that kind of stuff came up later. So I quit the drinking for 5 weeks, was sleeping, felt amazing. And I thought, oh my God, like, you know, am I going to continue with this?
Like, and at the rebirth.
End, yeah, at the end of the 5 weeks, I took a month to experiment with, well, what if I have a glass of wine? What if I do this? What's going to happen? And that was, I think, when I realized maybe these are more alcoholic behaviors, because I couldn't just have a beer with dinner. Like, that was not what I wanted. Like, I don't like the taste of alcohol. I never did. Like, I liked being drunk. So I think for some people that, you know, I love scotch, or I love this craft beer, I don't even know when they say that, I'm like, I don't even know what you're saying. Like, I could just inject this, I would do that, right? Like, it was about being drunk, not about, you know, enjoying nice wine or something like that. And in that month, I was like, ooh, okay, maybe you have a problem. Like, maybe this is about more than just the insomnia. And so the day that I promised myself that I was going to stop drinking for good, and this is obviously all like in retrospect, like looking back at this, I think I was very grateful to have the insomnia thing as a cover. Because when your entire social life revolves around drinking, and that's what people know you as, and that's what you do with your friends, to decide to stop drinking is a huge change. And I think the way that I, quote, got away with it, as far as like the judgment from other people, is they knew that I was this terrible insomniac. And now that I had quit drinking, I was sleeping. It was like a very easy decision for people to understand. Like, it's not like I quit drinking because I have a problem or because drinking is bad. It was kind of like people could feel like I wasn't judging them. Like, I quit drinking because I have some kind of a reaction to alcohol that makes me not sleep. Like, people understood it, if that makes sense. And so I think it gave me the cover that I needed to quit what I needed to quit for other reasons anyway.
That's intense, because I think even though it gave you the cover, it still takes a lot of courage to stop doing something that your social life is deeply embedded in and that you use in your life as central to your
experience. Dude, it was hard.
What came up for you in the space that alcohol used to inhabit? Like, when you remove the substance, shit's gonna come up.
Mm-hmm.
So what came to the surface?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because like, I quit drinking and started running on the same day. So in a lot of ways, I replaced drinking with running. And I think that's very common, you know, and it's, you know, from one addiction to another, right? And the timeline was interesting because I quit drinking May 1st of 2011. And June 1st, my then boyfriend and I moved from San Francisco to LA. So there was kind of like a fresh start feel around it where I had some friends in LA, but anyone that I met at that point never knew me otherwise. So I found it actually really helpful to have moved in that period because it gave me, again, a little bit of space to kind of reinvent. But I was very like bullheaded about it. I thought that I could change my life without actually changing my life. Like I thought, okay, I'm just going to stop drinking the same way that I'd say, oh, I'm not going to wear this sweater anymore. Like, I just thought it was like one thing would change, but everything else would be the same, you know? And so I was very concerned with keeping everything else the same. I was very afraid of people thinking that I wasn't fun anymore, you know? So I still went to the happy hours. I still went to everything that I was invited to. Oh, there's this cocktail party or they want to do this. And so I was making myself do all those things because I was so afraid that people would think that I wasn't fun. And it took about 6 months at my like 6 months of being sober when I finally stepped back and was like, wait, do I even want to be doing all of these things anymore? Like, do I want a social life that just revolves around drinking, even though I'm not drinking? Like it was, I kind of had to have that reflection point. And that's when running came in pretty handy because it gave me a new community and I could meet other people who were runners and or sober and or sober runners, right? So like it was kind of easy transfer into that. But I also, and that's what I needed at the time. Like I'm very grateful for running because that's what I needed. But I also think that that delayed dealing with, like you said, like a lot of the stuff because I didn't deal with it. I just became obsessed with running the way that I used to be obsessed with drinking. So it was actually really interesting. This past May was my 4 year soberversary. And I wrote this kind of like essay about it on my site. And through that reflection, I realized, like, I think in the past 4 years, I loved running, but I was afraid to stop running because I thought that if I stopped running, that I would start drinking again. Like, they were so closely linked to me, like, in my head that I thought, okay, well, this is who I was before, and that was bad. And, like, this is what I am now, and this has enabled me to not do that, so, like, I can't quit. And running became not fun because it felt like this thing that I had to do in order to stay sober. And you know, I remember it was the first weekend of May, right at, you know, it was the day after my 4 year soberversary, and I was on what was supposed to be a 2 hour trail run, and I was training for my first ultra marathon, and I was like 45 minutes into the run, and I just burst into tears, and I was like, I just don't want to do this. I was like out in the middle of nowhere. I was physically totally fine, like in like really great fitness, like great shape, and I was like, what am I doing this for? And so I walked all the way back to the car, which like after having run out, you know, 45 to 60 minutes was like, I had some like come to Jesus thinking to do, right? Like in my, in that walk. And I realized two things. One, I asked myself, if social media didn't exist and if you couldn't post from the finish line of this ultra marathon, if you couldn't put that on Instagram, would you still do this? And I was like, no, definitely not. And that was a big wake up call for me that I'm like, you're doing this for the wrong reasons. You're doing this because it sounds impressive. You're doing this because you want people to think a certain thing about you for having, you want to be an ultra marathoner. You want to have that label. And I was like, ooh, that's interesting. Like,
that's
okay.
That's my ego.
Right, exactly. So I was like, well, that goal's done. Like, no way am I doing this race because clearly I don't want to be doing it at all. And then the other thing that I realized, which was even more powerful than that, was I don't need running to not drink anymore. Like, I don't know what it was about like that 4 year date, but it like made me realize I'm not that same person anymore. And I can stop running without immediately start drinking. So at that point I was like, yeah, I'm done running. And not necessarily forever, but I was like, I'm done. So I just stopped. It was like this, and that brought up a whole other slew of stuff because that was my identity for a really long time, was like being a runner. And now it's been what, like 4 or 5 months? I mean, and I think I've run like maybe 5 times total in that time period. And it's been very interesting now. Like, I feel like more stuff is coming up now than did during the period of like initial transition.
And so in this period where stuff's coming up right now, how are you processing it? Like, what's in your toolbox?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, like talking about it. I mean, and that's part of the reason why I wanted to start my podcast and why I want to do the type of writing that I want to do, because I don't think, Like, I say this in like a nice way that like, I'm not special. I don't mean that in like a mean way. Like, none of us are, like, we think I'm the only one who has ever felt this thing. I'm the only one who worries about this. No, you're not. Like, we're all the same.
We're not alone.
So, right. Exactly. And so like kind of digging into that has been really helpful for me. I don't know. I don't know that I have, like, I'd like to say, oh, well, like, here's my, you know, toolbox of coaching tools, and this is what I do when I feel this way. I don't really know. Like, I'm in a period of kind of just figuring it out. And what that looks like is trying to just be aware of these kind of like feelings in real time and be okay with the fact that I don't really know what's next. Like, I feel like it was interesting. So when I stopped running, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to do something different. And so, you know, I'm going to do yoga. And I had done yoga lightly in the past, but, you know, so I did yoga, and I have kind of like a lingering wrist injury that like flared up. Okay. So, and then, you know, there's a lot of wristy things in yoga.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, I'm not going to do this. And then, you know, I'm going to do kickboxing. And that was so much fun, but also not great for my wrist. And this wrist stuff kept coming up. Okay, well, let me try CrossFit, right? So then I tried CrossFit, and the wrist stuff came up, but then it healed. And then something happened with my back. And it's like, and then I tried to start running again. And I had some immediate IT band stuff. So I'm in this like really interesting place where everything that I try to do to replace the running identity gets like thwarted by the universe. Like, I feel like I keep trying to be like, well, yoga's going to be my new thing. Well, CrossFit's going to be my new thing. Okay, well, kickboxing's going to be my new thing. And like every single time the universe is like, that's cute. Like, you need to sit this one out for a while. So I feel like I'm being, this is like a very hippie juju thing to say, but like, I feel like I'm being just forced to slow down. Nice walks.
Yeah.
And like moving meditation and doing like a lot of journaling and like all these things that I was like, I don't have time for that. Like, I'm too busy. Like, I don't, you know, I'm too restless. Like, it's just like, I think that sometimes you get what you need, not necessarily what you want. So it's not to say I'm never going to run again or I'm never going to find another thing. But right now I feel like I am just being pushed into just like sit with your shit for a while and just like deal with that.
And the universe is challenging you to step out of the light switch mentality and into, it sounds like, that slower day-to-day showing up, seeing what's in store, instead of having the total plan of being like, I am a runner, I'm gonna do my 8 miles today, it's gonna make me feel great, I'm gonna have a kick-ass day.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like what's gonna ground you now is very different than what it has in the past. And
yeah,
through that, I think immense growth is already happening.
I hope so, man. You know, it's this has been a very interesting summer because it's, you know, the first summer in, you know, years that I haven't been running. And for me, for my bipolar tends to be very seasonal, cyclical. Like, I tend to be much more unwell during the summer. That just is my pattern. And for better or worse, like, running is a pretty great like mental health management tool. Like, there is something, whether it's the endorphins or the endorphins plus like a sense of purpose when I get up in the morning that I'm like, this is what I have to do, that like gets me moving, that plus like the sense of completion when it's done. Like, there's a lot of really great stuff there that is now missing that I do need to replace. Like, I need to find something that's endorphiny, or there's definitely
some practice that will give you that.
And I haven't found that yet. And that's been a little bit disorienting. And I feel like I'm in a, this summer I had to cancel a couple of trips that I was supposed to go on. And, you know, I was supposed to go to a conference and lead a 5K run that I had to cancel at like 4 days beforehand. Like, things that, like, I'm not that person that just like cancels and bails out. And that was the first time that I ever had to pull out of something for like health related reasons, specifically mental health related reasons. And that was also an interesting growth experience of, okay, well, you know, this summer has been kind of like, we say that we have our beliefs or our priorities. It's easy to say my health is the most important thing, or my family is the most important thing, or whatever. But what do you do when these beliefs that you say that you have come up against inconvenience? And like, this has been like a lesson for me that I'm like, well, I say that I put my mental health first, but here's this situation where like, I'm really going to be letting someone down, and like, he's going to be disappointed and like probably is not going to want to collaborate with me again on something else. Okay, Nicole, like, you're in this situation. Like, how much do you really believe this thing? Right. And so.
Well, and returning to the idea of like having yourself in a box, I think what can be challenging battling mental illness and obviously being such a, it sounds like a public inspiring person that you are, is that those are two identities that sometimes are at odds with each other. And so when you call up someone and you're like, yeah, I can't come to your conference, I can't lead your 5K. Someone's like, that's not Nicole. You know, like, it's like that people don't understand mental illness and how debilitating it can be.
Yeah, it was, and I've been public about it for a long time, right? This wasn't some like big revelation. You know, I talk about this kind of stuff because, again, I feel like it should be talked about. Excuse me. And, you know, trying to lessen the stigma around it is really important to me. And so this wasn't, I think, new information for this person, but and whether this was just me projecting or not, like, I definitely kind of got the underlying vibe of, seriously, you can't just like suck this up and like make this happen. And whether that was me project, like, I have no idea. Like, this could have been all my own stuff, like, layered onto.
But that's how you felt.
That's how I felt.
And that's real.
I mean, I got off the phone. I mean, I cried for like 3 hours and I was just like, I felt so horrible and like, oh my God, I've let this person down. And like, then you start to go into a spiral of like, I'm so weak and like, I can't do the thing. It was just like not pretty. But on the heels of that, I actually felt very empowered. Like, you know what? I asked for what I needed. And like, if that doesn't sit right with someone, then that's too bad.
And I lived by my values.
Yeah.
In that moment.
The other thing that it really brought up for me is kind of reinforcing that we never have any idea what's really going on for somebody else. Like I was talking to my mom about it afterwards, and she said something, because that was the, you know, the period of the summer that I was like really particularly unwell. And I mean, not suicidal, not kind of to that level, but she said, this person doesn't know that. Like, that's a very real thing. Like, you could have been, and this is the type of, like, when someone's not understanding, this can be the type of thing that, like, makes someone feel so terrible that they self-harm, or that they, like, obviously that was her kind of taking it to an extreme, but that conversation that I had with her made me realize that what I try to take from difficult conversations or situations where either my feelings are hurt or, you know, whatever, is how can I use this as a learning experience for how I want to treat other people or how I want to interact in the world? And so what I took from that is like, I need to be more compassionate and more empathetic and more open to the fact that there's probably stuff going on with people that they, you know, if I have someone scheduled to be a podcast guest and they cancel at the last minute, if they give a reason or if they don't give a reason, I really don't know the truth of what's going on. So for me to, like, I need to just be so open to the fact that it might be like absolute meltdown city for them over there. That's fine. Like, it's like kind of, I really felt it as like a push to like exercise more grace, like both to myself, but also to other people, because we just do not know. Like, yeah. This person, I don't think knew the depth of like how bad I was feeling. That's okay. Like, that's not their responsibility to know that. But it was definitely like a reminder for me that I don't know that for anyone else, you know, ever.
Yeah, and that we can judge very easily. I think that's a part of the human instinct, is to judge people. And that's because it's just to read them and be like, oh, they have their shit together, they're doing well, or whatever. But we really don't know the stories and the things that are going on underneath people. And always giving people the benefit of the doubt is a practice that I'm also really working with in my life. I'd love to hear from you a little bit about your bipolar disorder and what that means. Like, what is bipolar disorder and how does that manifest for Nicole?
Yeah, so it's a weighty question because I never want to be in the position where I feel like I'm defining things or like speaking for everyone. So
yeah, totally.
My issue, I guess, with, I don't even want to say mental illness, I think anything, is that obviously in order for something to be diagnosable, they have to have like criteria that has to be met in order for something to be diagnosed. But even within that, it's a huge spectrum. So like my experience of, you know, type 2 bipolar disorder is going to be so wildly different. Probably there's always commonalities, but from someone else's. So I would never want, you know, someone to listen to this and think that's what it's like, or, you know, this defines anything. So that's kind of my like big disclaimer of that. So is there anything specifically that you like want to know about? I'm happy to speak to specific things or...
Yeah, I mean, how did you figure out that you had bipolar disorder? Like, what was the turning point where someone needed to put that label on you?
Yeah, so knowing the information that I know now, the symptoms started to present sophomore year in college, which is, from what I have read and been told, pretty normal, like very early 20s, especially for women. And, you know, I had some long depressive episodes. I'd say mild to moderate, you know, not couldn't get out of bed or absolutely couldn't function, but definitely decreased functioning, which at that point I just kind of, you know, assumed it's college, it's stress, and or I'm lazy because, you know, I had like a lot of reasons for it. I never really thought anything of it. You know, and that went on for a while. And the thing with, so my bipolar disorder type 2, it's characterized by at least one episode of severe depression. I think it's that lasts 2 weeks or more. I think that's like the actual criteria, paired with hypomania. So the difference between, I mean, again, I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on the internet. I'm not the best person to say this, but you know, hypomania is, it's similar to mania, but it's lessened symptoms. So it's heightened energy, you know, insomnia can definitely be a part of that. Restlessness, irritability, kind of grandiose ideas, hypersexuality is like a big part of that. And that was a big part of it for me, like, you know, sleeping with the wrong people and being in these kinds of situations. And, but the thing with hypomania is it actually feels awesome for the most part. So it's like, you're super creative for me. So I was super creative and productive, and that I never thought that was a problem. So I never, and this is very common for people that I have talked to that got misdiagnosed. Usually they're diagnosed with depression first because that's what they go to see someone for, because they don't feel good. But because it wasn't full-blown mania, I didn't have a psychotic episode, you know, it wasn't anything like that. It was all just felt like, it felt great, you know? And so I first went to see someone, you know, you got a certain number of counseling sessions, you know, free with, you know, at school, right? Like you go to the place and I didn't even really know what to talk about. And I feel like that person wasn't the best equipped to kind of deal with me. And I was like, this is nonsense. I'm not going to do this anymore. I finally went to see someone for real, 2007-ish. So like a good couple of years after like symptoms had been starting. And, you know, at that point I went to see them because I felt like the depression had worsened and I felt like a mood switching that didn't seem to mirror that which I saw in other people, that it would be, you know, I would feel really depressed and then I would feel really up in a very quick, like it was kind of like up and down and up and down. And so originally I got diagnosed with cyclothymia. I think I'm pronouncing that right. My diagnosis, I don't even know how to pronounce, which I know this isn't how people like to describe it, but for lack of a better thing, like a less severe bipolar disorder, where it's like the symptoms, but it's like very mild. It's the mood swings, but it's very mild, you know, on both ends. And got put on mood stabilizer. I mean, at this point I was drinking so much, and that's like drugs and alcohol are the worst possible thing that you could do for any kind of mental health related situation, particularly mood disorders. So I was on this medication that obviously was not working because I was like drinking myself into the ground. And so this was 2007, and early 2008 was when I was in a relationship that I didn't want to be in. And instead of having a mature conversation, I moved to California full time and thought, because I was still running camp, I just picked up and left. And this very clear memory, I was in the bathroom on the airplane and I had what was, you know, then like a full bottle of these pills, like these mood stabilizers. And I flushed them down the toilet on the airplane. I was like, well, when I get to California, I'm just not going to be crazy anymore. Like I thought this was something that I could decide. I thought, you know what? I don't need to take this. Like, I'm totally fine. Everything's great. It's this relationship that's bringing me down. Like, I blamed a lot of other things. And I thought, that's it. The plane's going to land and I'm not going to be crazy. Like, this was like, I thought this was a really great plan. Of course, there's a lot of things in life that you can decide. Deciding not to have a mental illness is, in fact, not one of them. So, you know, it kind of hit a point for me. I had my longest hypomanic period followed by my longest depressive episode ever, right around that last summer of camp, just like just very dangerous. Like a lot of the markers of mania are, you know, impulse decision, like bad impulse control, spending money that you don't have, you know, drinking and driving. Like if you go down the checklist, like that summer, check, 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 like all the things, and then horrible depression. And, but then again, still it was like 4 years before I went back to a doctor and like actually got properly diagnosed. And at that point he was like, you have bipolar disorder. Like, this is not what you thought it was, which was a relief. Sometimes having a name to put to something was a relief. But he wasn't the best doctor for me. I think having the right fit doctor is really important. And he was very by the book and very aggressive and very, you have to take this medication forever. And like, I was just in a very sensitive place. And so he put me back on medication and I had some side effects from it that, you know, I tried to talk to him, well, can we try something else? Well, no, like this is the thing that you have to take. And I felt not heard. So my response to that, again, I could kind of kick myself for that, but was, okay, I'm just going to stop taking this. And like, it was very like, this system has failed me. This medication's not working. This guy's an asshole. I'm done. Right. And that also didn't work so well. So it's been like, since then, that was in summer 2013. So a couple years ago, you know, finding a different doctor and doing all that kind of stuff and learning what, you know, triggers are for me, and just trying to, the hardest part of it has been taking it seriously, but not living in fear of it, because I don't want it to be, like, travel's a really hard thing for me because that tends to be a trigger. Mostly because I don't sleep well in new places, and not sleeping is the trigger for me. I don't want to say I can't travel. I can't go anywhere. You know, like, I don't want to go down that road of, you know, because I have bipolar disorder, I can't XYZ thing, right? Like, other than drinking, I don't really want there to be anything that I feel like I tell myself I can't do. Like, I don't want to limit it, but I also don't want to be stupid. So I have no answers for myself. I'm still balancing it. I'm still like learning how to do that.
And it's so cool that you're in the process of it, but you're so honest about the process. And I love that, because I feel like in our world, or at least in a lot of the podcasts I listen to, people interview someone who has their product. Maybe they have their famous book and they're this bestseller, or they've overcome their depression and they're on the other side of it. And what you're speaking to is, yeah, you're still in the process. You're still figuring it out. And that's awesome.
Thanks. No, I mean, yeah, it feels good to have that acknowledged. And, you know, I appreciate that. But I also think that, like, what you just said speaks to why I need to make some career changes, because I felt like I had boxed myself into the before and after story type of thing. Not as much with the mental health stuff, but, you know, I never want to be someone that another person would look at and, well, like, she has this figured out and it's easy for her to, you know, whatever, but not for me. Or like, I'm not comfortable with that. And I kind of think of myself as like a recovering self-help addict, because I really have gone down that spiral too of like, read all the books, listen to all the podcasts, and like, there's a lot of good in there. You know, there's some of those books and podcasts and speakers and people that have had like a fundamental impact on me. But I also think that it's a slippery slope, because it puts us in the mindset of thinking that our lives are problems to be fixed. And I don't think they are. I don't think your life is something that has to be fixed. And it's very easy. Okay, well, you know, you read this book and, okay, well, I have to make this change to my diet. Well, and then I hear on the podcast that this is this person's morning routine, so probably I need that to be my morning routine. And like, you get into a state of like perpetual dissatisfaction,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
And it's not like, I definitely have a growth mindset and I'm all about that, but I think that there's a way in which that can come from a positive place. And I know for me, it was getting to the point that it wasn't. And so like, I'm very clear going forward in the work that I want to do that I feel like that's kind of my message, is like, your life is not a problem to be fixed. And like, you're not alone, whatever, you know, you think you're feeling, you're definitely not the only one. And like, we're all just doing the best we can, right? And like, that's it. Like, everyone's just trying to do the best that they can. Like, I really believe that. Even like, when I've done shitty things at the time, honestly, that was the best that I could do. And so like, what you said before about working on like the judgment and that type of stuff, like, that's the only thing that helps me with that, is like, this person who did this thing that really pissed me off or whatever, okay, Nicole, like, they're doing the best they can
with what they
like,
have.
They're
in
just
that moment.
At any moment, like, and our best looks very different on different days. And like, that's not only like a mental health related thing, but that has also helped crystallize that for me. Like, there's some days, you know, I look at kind of like the worst depressive periods where like the thought of making toast was like the most overwhelming thing. And I say that now, like, that's hilarious to me. Like, just go make the toast. But I couldn't make toast. And so I'm like, okay, like, we're not robots. We're not the same every single day. Like, and it doesn't matter whether you know, have a diagnosed illness or not, like, we're not robots. Like, some days you're going to have more energy than others, you know? And so I think that there's a lot of, with the self-help space, I see this a lot in kind of the entrepreneurial space too, this like, you know, go, 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 like, don't give up, like, morning routine every day, do your most important thing first, like, no matter what. Like, dude, some days, like, I just need to watch Gilmore Girls for 6 hours and like, lay on the floor. And if I don't let that be okay, then I wind up burning out a lot. And I think it's like, we have to respect the ebbs and flows of our creativity,
dynamic being, yeah,
everything. Like some days it's just not. Like it's, and I, you know, I've talked to and worked with a lot of beginning runners and like on kind of the mental side of things. And this comes up a lot where like sometimes it is just, okay, suck it up and get over it. But like sometimes it's not, like we can't like brute force our way through everything. And like that being able to give ourselves a break, I say this 100% to myself because this is something that I don't really know how to do and that I'm still working on, how to not equate being busy with being worthy. Like, you know, like that was a huge thing for me. Like that's why I'm like freaking on my email so much. And that's why I'm like, okay, well, because if I'm doing this, then I'm busy and that means that I'm like worthy. But if I'm like sitting on the couch with a cup of tea and like reading a book, then I'm not worthy. And I don't actually believe that, but my behavior suggests otherwise. And so I think what started, to kind of come full circle, what started as I think that I want to make a career change has in the past couple of weeks, I think, clarified for me into I'm pretty desperate for some like deep healing. And I think that's what came out of the stopping running, continuing to get hurt all the time. I just got a bunch of blood tests done, you know, for some medical things that they think I might have. Like a lot of stuff's coming up that I'm like, I think I need to just push pause on a lot of things and like heal some stuff. Whether that means finding a different spirit, like finding a spiritual community here in Bend that I'm relatively new to being here. Whether it means more intense therapy, or like I'm just feeling kind of like in like a little bit of a shaky place. And so I'm grateful that the circumstances have worked out to kind of give myself the space to do that. So I feel like when I look ahead to the rest of the year, right? Like let's say like that will really be my focus. And that feels terrifying. And I, you know, well, really like the negative, like, you know, monster voice in my head is, that's so self-indulgent. Like, who are you that you think that you can just like take a couple months off from like earning money to like focus on healing? Like there's a lot of like stuff that comes up there, but that's what I'm interested in writing about kind of in real time, is like this process of, I have no answers. I'm feeling pretty broken. Let's see what happens. Right. And kind of like on that journey of like the mantra that's like keeps coming up for me is grit and grace, like figuring out the intersection of like grit and grace and like what that looks like.
It's a powerful intersection, and I am really excited to just see what writing comes to the surface for you and follow it.
Thanks. Yeah, me too. I think I feel good. Like I feel like this is the type of stuff, it's almost like I feel like the type of writing that I'm doing right now, in place of a blog, I do a weekly email, and I mean, I guess newsletter is the right word, even though I don't really like that word, but it's basically like kind of like short blogs by email type of thing. And Grit and Grace, I just decided that's what I'm going to title them, like this, what this like series is right now, and just kind of like on a weekly basis. And I haven't in the past sent emails necessarily that frequently, but I'm moving into this where I'm like, let's see what that feels like at the end of the week, to just like talk about the things that I feel like I need some extra grit and grace for. Mostly, I mean, partially as a way to chronicle that for myself. Like, I think it's easy to lose sight of this kind of stuff, like as time goes by, but to have like a weekly checkpoint of like, what was this week, you know? And then for other people, you know, hopefully it's helpful for them, just, you know, just to see someone else like explore this space, I guess. But yeah.
To close it up, I'd love for you to speak to how listeners can cultivate more real talk in their life. I think we are in a world where people are moving to having deeper, more honest conversations with one another. But I found, especially as like a post-collegiate, there's a lot of surface talk that goes on. You know, everyone's like, so what are you doing with your life? What's your job? Where do you live? Like, and like a real talk is scary for a lot of people, especially with guys who are my age. And I think people of a lot of different ages are scared of real talk because of the way our cultures have guarded us. And so speak to how people can get more real in the way in which they talk to one another, to themselves.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because I feel like those are two complementary but kind of fundamentally different things. I think it starts with being able to do the real talk with yourself, because, or maybe it doesn't start with, I don't know, chicken or the egg situation, but, you know, I have found a lot of power in being able to admit what's true to myself. And, you know, I recently did a journaling exercise where, you know, at the top of the page, I wrote, what is true for me that I have been denying? And I was like, just go with that. And I mean, I filled like so many pages that it was crazy. And that's kind of how I came to a lot of these conclusions. But this idea of like, again, like getting to the heart of what's true without judgment. Like we have to just, first of all, let what's true be true. So I feel like that question is a great place to start. Like what's true for you that you have been denying? It doesn't mean that you have to tell anyone else that truth, but got to start with what's true, right? And that's totally scary. And sometimes it takes like a lot of layers to get through. So I think that's a helpful practice. When it comes to communication, Brené Brown's work is my favorite with this, you know, on vulnerability and shame. And, you know, she talks about, because I think that we also, I agree with you in terms of the struggling for real talk, but I think kind of alongside that is a culture of oversharing for like shock value.
Interesting. Yeah.
And I think, you know, you look at a lot of the like personal essays and narratives and stuff that are published. And I'm so glad that I feel like kind of the personal essay and memoir style is having like a resurgence. That's kind of how it feels to me now. And I'm thrilled because that's the type of writing that I do, but it's very extreme, you know, like this terrible thing happened to me in the past, or, you know, like, I don't even know. You could look at any example, right? It's usually about these like very, very extreme things. It's kind of like who can top each other's personal story. It's like this very like, and there's a difference between oversharing, I think, and kind of like real talk vulnerability. And one of the things that I've heard Brené Brown say is, and this isn't going to be verbatim, but it's about like kind of cultivating the ability to share your truth, your vulnerability, whatever it is, with the people who have earned it. So it's not just like I think that's kind of why this conversation about being authentic, right, in quotes or whatever, is more nuanced than we think, because the same way that, you know, if I think you and I are having a different conversation now than you would have with my father if you met him. It doesn't mean that both of those aren't you. This is a total stranger. This is like an elder, right? Like I have a different conversation, you know, with my mother-in-law than with my across the street neighbor. We just talk about different things. It doesn't mean that any one of those is not authentic. It means that we're like multifaceted people. So I think there also needs to be a little bit of like relaxing around this idea of authenticity, because I don't think real talk is spill your deepest secrets all the time. Otherwise you're not being real. I find this a lot around like Instagram too, for example, that, you know, there's this whole like backlash against like, you can't just share the highlight reel of your life, but like also can't we just accept that that's kind of what Instagram is? And like, that's fine. Like I like pretty pictures. Like not to say I don't love when people are faking their life, right? Like don't say everything's amazing if it's not, like that's not very authentic, but it's okay if what you want to do is like capture like beautiful pictures of food and share it. Like I think that's fine. Like I think there's this expectation we have of everyone to just like bare their soul and like bleed all the time doesn't do it for me. I don't know if this is the answer that you were expecting, but so I think it's being honest with yourself about what's true, accepting that like authenticity isn't a black and white, like I'm either telling my darkest secrets or I'm not. And then just taking the first step in conversations to talk about like something that's a little bit more real, like whatever it looks like. It doesn't have to be, you know, where did you grow up versus like, you know, suicide or like whatever the other, you know, or like tell me about the time you were like so drunk you couldn't whatever, but
what's real for you that day,
right? And it's like getting out of that reflexive habits of how are you, I'm good, how are you, right? Like the getting out of that. But also something that I am personally working on, which is an unbelievable challenge, I read this book earlier this year, the very end of last year, called A Complaint-Free World, and it's all about basically like why we complain. And the like challenge that it poses is that you try to not complain, gossip, use sarcasm or criticize for 21 days. And you wear like a bracelet or a hair tie or something. And every time you do one of those behaviors, you move it from one wrist to the other. And like that it takes sometimes years to get to 21 days, right? Like I've never gotten past day 4. And so it's like, you just keep resetting. You do it, you're back at day 1. You do it, you're back at day 1. And what it pointed out that I'd never really thought of is how much of our like social bonding is based on bitching. Yes. And like, just being aware of that, like even if you don't take on that challenge, just like being aware of how often it's like, let's bitch about our jobs, let's complain about the weather, that like, it's always this kind of like misery type of, so trying to just develop relationships that aren't based on that. You know, like, I love to ask, like, my favorite kind of icebreaker question is, like, what are you totally obsessed with right now? Like, I love hearing whether it's like, you know, your new pumpkin bread recipe, or this, you know, a friend of mine like is always obsessed with a different TV show. Yeah, tell me about it. Tell me why you're obsessed. Just like starting to, like, starting, what are you excited about right now? Or just like getting to know like what makes people excited. You know,
I think what inspires.
That can be the entry point into like real talk. You know, it doesn't, I think there's like a lot of layers. I don't think it has to be this like pressure to like be so real, because then that just becomes like another, like the pressure to be authentic, that just is another way that people fake it, you know? So exactly. It's like just like, let's just relax, you know, and like not be afraid to talk about some things, and you know, I think
see what happens.
Yeah,
this was a lot of fun.
Yeah, for me too. I feel like we just bounced around a lot of different topics, but thanks.
Yeah,
it's good.
I think we got a little real.
I know, right? Real talk. Yeah, it's good real talk. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you.
Do you feel inspired to get real? I do. My conversation with Nicole inspired me to think about how I've not really told all of you my story, and I'm excited to begin to share it over the next couple months, and I'm really grateful to Nicole for showing me and many others that it's possible to live at the intersection of grit and grace. So before I sign off for the week, two important things to share. First, if you want to win a free swag bag of Nutso, the only 7 nut and seed butter on the planet, all you have to do is leave Running on Om a review on the iTunes store. Send a screenshot of your review to runningonom@gmail.com or tweet it to @runningonom. And the giveaway ends October 31st. The winner will be randomly announced and chosen by November 2nd, 2015. And so my second and final ask of all of you is that you share this podcast with one person. Maybe you tell your running buddy, your friend, your mother, your partner, your mailman, your dog, I'm committed to publishing 2 podcasts a week, and in order to keep this up, I need your help in spreading the word about Rue. Whether it be a tweet, Instagram comment, Facebook post, or email, reach out to me, let me know you tuned in, and share this conversation with just one person who's ready to dig into real talk. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting Running on Om. Deep gratitude to each and every one of you. Yes, you. This is your host, Julia Hanlon, and I hope you have a Rue-filled day.